This is Health Matters, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we discuss the latest medical advice, news, and research to help you live a happier and healthier life. My name is Kristen Meinzer. I'm a writer and journalist. And this episode, we're talking about fertility care. Fertility care. What exactly does that entail? And what are the reasons a patient or a couple may be struggling with their fertility? Our guest is Dr. Zarak Khan, a gynecologist and reproductive endocrinologist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Last year, he released the second edition of his book, Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility and Conception. Dr. Zarak Khan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you today. And we always say anything that creates more awareness for patients and the general population, we're always so enthusiastic about. So thank you.
Absolutely, as are we. Let's start from the very beginning. How do you define infertility from a clinical perspective, and how widespread is it?
Infertility happens to impact, it's to be 1 out of 10, but it's not all considered 1 out of 8 couples would have some sort of issues with getting pregnant in the United States. Clinically, infertility is defined as a couple that has been trying for more than 12 months and are still not able to get to their goal of a pregnancy, though that can be also after 6 months if the female's age is greater than 35. And we'll talk a little bit more, but we do see that in heterosexual couples, the female's age sort of dictates a big prognosis factor or dictates success versus not, because the age of the egg really matters a lot when it comes to fertility. But it's 6 months or 12 months of trying without being able to be successful.
What are some of the causes of infertility?
When it comes to causes of infertility, the one big one that I always go to first that we tend to not think of or talk about at all is male factor infertility. Globally, if we look at it, 65% of infertile couples have some form of male factor infertility, especially when we are talking about heterosexual couples. And, oh, by the way, majority of the times it does happen to be issues with sperm. And unlike other forms of female infertility, where the menstrual function can be the guide to tell us if there's something working adequately or not, male factor infertility is very occult. It's hidden. People don't know if they have abnormal semen analysis, because testosterone production for what we call masculine features like hair growth and muscle building and other function requires very little testosterone compared to adequate sperm production. One thing that I really emphasize on is that infertility is actually a couple's issue, but ironically, it becomes a woman's social burden to carry. So it's really important that we test people and test semen analyses to see if there's any element of male factor or fertility issues.
You said that over 65% of global infertility has some form of male factor. What specifically is it that's going on with the men to cause this?
So number one is there's a lag of sort of diagnosis because there's no symptoms. So what I mean by that is women's sort of litmus paper test is abnormality in menstrual cycles. That's something that's obvious. So if you start having abnormalities in menstrual cycle, you skip periods, you miss ovulation, you have spotting, abnormality in bleeding, those are obvious things that women can gather information around that and go right away for evaluation. Whereas with male factor infertility, you could have had zero sperm in the ejaculate. You would still have normal sexual function. You will still have no issues with intercourse. You would still have an ejaculate, but still not know that there's no sperm present in that ejaculate because there's no signs, obvious signs that men can point towards. It's only in the extremes of male factor infertility when there's issues with testosterone production, when we see things like inability to have intercourse or achieve an erection, for which men seek medical care. Number two, which I think plays a very, very important role, and I speak gingerly when I say this because I know that this is a little bit of a generalization against men, but I'm a man myself. And for somebody that has practiced in 3 continents across 6 countries, it is obvious to me that historically we have always put that burden on women of the ability to produce and then raise families, which is mm-hmm. factually incorrect. Medically, it's incorrect. It takes two to tango. And so I think that's where that advocacy is really important and bridging those gender gaps and divides that we still have in the medical field to say that, no, we need to get men tested as well. I'll tell you, I have so many different female patients that will come and will want to do everything. They will even be willing to do surgery. But when I talk to them about getting their partners tested, they take a pause and they say, well, I don't know if he's open to that, or I don't know if that's a possibility. And so that sort of makes me think that we still have a lot of work to do in mm-hmm. these areas in making sure that we can make men significantly aware of their responsibilities when it comes to playing a role in fertility evaluations and treatments.
Wow. The need for these kinds of conversations about male factor infertility are so important, especially because I'm sure a lot of us are hearing much of this information for the first time. Now, in the event of female factor infertility, what are the different kinds of issues that could be at play?
So to make it simple, I tell my patients that for a healthy pregnancy, we need sperm, we need eggs, we need a uterus and open fallopian tubes, mm-hmm. right? So we need egg and sperm to make the embryo. We need the open fallopian tubes for the embryo to be transported from the ovary area to the uterine cavity. And then we need a uterus for implantation and embryo to develop into a pregnancy. There could be issues with sperm. And in the female, there could be issues with the egg, the tube, or the uterus. And of course, the most common one that we see is issues related with the egg. Mother Nature's plan for peak fertility is at age 22, but it's a little bit out of sync with what society is doing at this point, because we know that we have a lot of women in the professional work field that are delaying childbirth for very, very valid reasons. And I usually joke with my patients and I say, well, we were children at 22.
I'd say that's true of most of us.
Right. And so getting that peak fertility at 22, I feel like becomes very, very unfair. But that's a design, right? And so when we see extremes of reproductive age, what we mean by that is teenage and late third decade, so 38 onwards, which to me is the peak of youth and peak of other parts in life, but almost towards the end of reproductive age span, which can be very, very alarming to a lot of patients. And it can be very blindsiding to a lot of our patients as well.
Mm. Part of why it's so alarming for women who are closing in on or passing age 38 is because we know that we're born with a finite number of eggs.
So really what happens is at birth, women are born with about 2 million primordial eggs. They're very early primitive eggs that are just in resting phase. They're in hibernation. When menarche happens and periods start, and more so when periods get regular, every month, even before a menstrual cycle happens, the body is programmed to recruit a fresh new crop of eggs. Out of the 2 million reserve that we have, about 300 to 400 primordial eggs will start moving and shaking. And at the beginning of the menstrual cycle, when period starts, depending on the ovarian reserve that changes with age, the ovary will push forward somewhere between 9 to 25 eggs to start the race for ovulation. And physiologically, only one wins that race. So that ability of the body to recruit 300-400 eggs that start moving and shaking to then push out 9 to 25 eggs to start the race to ovulation, which is a fairly long race and a competitive race, that is all outside of a fertility specialist's control. That is dependent on age and inherent factors of the ovary. Now, we as fertility providers can manipulate the eggs that actually start that race to ovulation, but physiologically, only one is released.
Wow. And a lot of eggs lost along the way.
Yeah. So with the ebb and flow of menstrual cycles, there is that loss of eggs or ovarian reserve. Also, women ask, I've been on birth control for so long, I haven't even had menstrual cycles. But that cycling still occurs despite of whether you're on birth control or not. And that reproductive aging or ovarian aging still continues to happen.
Now, we've talked about the eggs and how they play a part in female infertility, but it's not just the eggs that are a factor. What about the fallopian tubes?
Of course, tubes can be a big issue as well, and physical blockage of a tube can be very, very detrimental for pregnancy. Globally, tubal blockage is a big problem that typically comes from infectious origins. So pelvic inflammatory disease, from common things like gonorrhea or chlamydia, or even E. coli can block fallopian tubes. Ruptured appendices or other inflammation in the bowel area or the abdominal cavity, diseases like endometriosis, they can all block fallopian tubes. And then finally, issues with the uterus. And there's several common things like uterine fibroids that a lot of women have. It's important to understand that not all fibroids lead to fertility issues, but some specific kind of fibroids can pose a big challenge with fertility and may have to be addressed prior to fertility treatments or even prior to trying. Other conditions like adenomyosis, which is a cousin variant of endometriosis, which is disease in the uterine wall, can still be a big factor.
I mean, you've told us about some of the things you're evaluating in women, like fallopian health and fibroids and so on. What exactly are you looking for in men?
So it's as simple as just one semen analysis that will look at all numbers. And ironically, this is when I'm talking to couples that are hesitant in getting males tested. I say, like, look, the female partner has to go through blood work, has to go through internal ultrasounds with vaginal probes, has to go through fallopian tube testing, which, oh, by the way, is not a very fun experience for a lot of people. And we need to pre-medicate them with high-dose ibuprofen and things to prevent spasms from fallopian tube testing. Men just need to give one ejaculate sample for a semen analysis. The three major things that we look at is the motility of the sperm, how motile they are, how many sperm there are, how many number they are, and then finally the morphology of the sperm, what they look like.
And what is motility?
We sometimes use these fancy words because it makes us look smart, right? So motility really is motion or forward progression or how the sperm swim. So for my patients, I describe them as if they've seen tadpoles. Sperm look like tadpoles. They swim, and we want sperm to swim progressively in a forward direction. If you look at a slide of sperm, the first time I ever looked at a slide of sperm, my mind was blown, because you expect every single sperm to be normal, but only about 4% of the entire sperm population is actually normal in the ejaculate.
You're kidding. Wow.
I'm absolutely not. Sperm can squiggle and go round and round. Sperm can go in different directions. We like the ones that swim head on and straight. I use the word morphology as well. And morphology is when we take 200 sperm heads and look at how many look like a textbook sperm. We look at the physical features of what the sperm looks like. Because sperm can have no tails, no necks, two heads, three heads, a sperm without a head. And so they could be all different variations of sperm. And if you come to think about it, it does actually make sense, because the testes' job is to make millions of sperm in a day. And if we look at a factory that produces millions of any product in one day, we all know that the quality check on those products would be very, very poor. Even if it was just a shoe factory that was making 2 million shoes a day, there would be a lot of issues with quality control there. And that's what we emphasize on. And that's what we, because a lot of times men will also say, well, but my semen analysis was normal. My numbers were fine. Well, it's not just the numbers that matter. It's how many of those numbers are normal looking and swimming normally in a forward direction.
Infertility is affecting more and more of our population. Today, 1 in 8 couples have difficulty conceiving, and there are a variety of reasons for that. First, there are the female infertility factors. There can be issues with the eggs, uterus, and the fallopian tubes, and of course, age plays a part, as women are having children later than ever before. Then there's the male infertility factors, which we don't talk about nearly enough. They're a bit harder to identify because male factor infertility doesn't really show up in symptoms like it does for women. This makes testing so important for men. A semen analysis allows doctors to look at the sperm to check their motility, how motile they are, how many there are, and also their morphology, or what they look like. Next, let's talk about less common fertility situations. Now, doctor, are there any cases where you have heterosexual couples where neither the man nor the woman is presenting any fertility issues, but they're still having trouble getting pregnant?
Believe it or not, in 1 out of 5 couples, we will see no issues in either partner. We will see that there is robust ovarian reserve, there are patent and open fallopian tubes, there's normal appearing uterus, excellent sperm, and couples are still not able to conceive. We call that unexplained infertility. And 20% of the couples that we actually see in the clinic do carry that very frustrating diagnosis of unexplained infertility. To me, fertility is like a puzzle, and there could be several pieces that could be missing or dysfunctional. And that's our goal, is to investigate and to evaluate the different moving parts so that we can address areas that need some help and require some more efficiency.
So it used to be 1 in 10 couples were facing fertility challenges, and now it's 1 in 8. That's a big increase. Do we know what's behind that?
There's several different reasons. The one that we know of is delayed childbearing. So we know that men and women are both very, very professional now. We average age of childbearing is getting delayed, and also family number and sizes. So family building is different in the year 2024 than when it was in the 70s or the 80s. People have had now kids earlier and they want kids later in life after a pause or a gap. So that, I think, is a big factor that plays a role. Other than that, there's several speculations and hypotheses that sort of talk about environmental exposures and several correlations, but no causations that we know. Correlation meaning several things that are related to maybe infertility, but nothing that has been proven to cause issues with fertility. Another observation that you'll find very interesting is that as we have increased numbers of infertile couples, we have also progressively lowered the standard of what we call a normal semen analysis. So for example, right now, 15 million sperm per 1 ml of ejaculate is considered normal. This was not the case in probably about 2 decades ago, where 20 million per 1 ml was normal. And then prior to that, it was, I believe, 30 or 35 million per ml that was normal. So there is some very interesting doomsday hypotheses around that of how the human race will become obsolete when sperm counts go down to zero. I wouldn't go to that extreme, but that is just some interesting fictional reading maybe. But there is a scientific observation that we are seeing overall sperm counts decrease in men too, to the point where we have to keep moving our normal goalpost.
Wow. And do we know why that is?
I would say no concrete scientific plausible ideas.
When we talk about fertility, I want to make sure to talk about fertility when it comes to transgender patients who have started going through gender-affirming hormone therapy. How do those treatments potentially impact fertility?
We are seeing, of course, as trans health is becoming more and more popular, more robust, which we're so excited to see. And especially at Mayo, we have a big transgender clinic as well. We are really wanting to meet with all these patients as they're going through gender affirmation procedures, whether that is medical gender affirmation or surgical gender affirmation, because we do know that, of course, with surgical gender affirmation, that's irreversible. It's where the reproductive organs are removed. But with medical gender affirmation, there could be issues with prolonged estrogen exposure. So for trans women or individuals that were assigned male at birth, when they go on estrogen supplementation or medication for gender affirmation, there could be issues with prolonged estrogen exposure. That can cause irreversible damage to the testes if surgery has not been done and impact sperm production after a certain amount of exposure and time. It doesn't happen immediately, but it is best to start having conversations about if that patient or individual can preserve some sperm for the future before going on estrogen. We can still try if they're on estrogen to see if the sperm counts are good enough or not, but that can cause irreversible damage to the testes.
What about trans men who are taking testosterone?
For trans men, going on testosterone can stop menstrual function, but it really doesn't accelerate or completely deplete ovarian reserve. So that would be more age dependent. And sometimes if a 45-year-old individual is going through gender affirmation, it would be difficult to get eggs from that trans man, not because of the fact that they are on testosterone, but because of the fact that they're 45. And so it's more age dependent in that scenario. to the point where we actually even offer fertility services to our trans men that are on T, on testosterone. We don't even get them sometimes off of T, and we can do an IVF cycle and get some eggs in that scenario. Now, that might take longer, and it might be a more sort of expensive cycle because the medications needed are much higher when you're on testosterone, but we can certainly stimulate people even if they're on testosterone.
Will drinking orange juice help prevent kidney stones? Is it true you can get rid of bad breath by chewing parsley? Does caffeine improve or worsen a headache? We've all tried a quick fix or two, but for the ultimate guide to at-home treatment, look no further than Mayo Clinic Guide to Home Remedies. Our practical guide offers ways to minimize your risk of disease and injury and prepares you to treat conditions at home until you can see a medical provider. Grab your copy of Mayo Clinic Guide to Home Remedies today at mcpress.mayoclinic.org and use code HEALTHMATTERS, all one word, for 10% off your order.
While there are many reasons why a couple could be dealing with infertility, in some special cases, about 20% of them, there are couples where neither the man nor the woman presents any infertility issues, but are still finding it difficult to get pregnant. Another important aspect of fertility care is fertility care for transgender patients, especially those who are undergoing gender affirmation, both medically and surgically. This requires a lot of pre-planning. For trans women who were assigned male at birth, they may have complications from taking estrogen, which can damage the testes and the sperm. So it's important to make a plan to preserve sperm for the future before starting estrogen. For trans men who were assigned female at birth, going on testosterone can stop menstrual function, but the ovarian reserve may still be there. So, even while a trans man is still on testosterone, it's possible to do an IVF cycle and extract some eggs for safekeeping. Next, let's hear more from Dr. Khan about fertility options available to prospective parents. So, Dr. Khan, when should patients consider consulting a fertility specialist about pregnancy concerns?
I think the right answer is variable. The party line advice is, if you've been trying for one whole year without success and the female is under 35, yes, we need evaluation. The female is above 35 and you've tried for more than 6 months and you're not successful, yes, you need evaluation. If menstrual cycles are irregular and all over the place where you're not having monthly cycles and regular ovulation, you need fertility advice and consultation.
Got it.
If there are other specific things that we talk about, a smoking history, especially in women under 35, if women are smokers and are unable to get pregnant, I would say in 6 months, they ought to consult because smoking is related to accelerated ovarian aging, and we have to rule that out. If somebody has had multiple ovarian surgeries in the past, so if somebody has had one or two surgeries on the ovary, that can take a big impact on ovarian reserve, I think they need some form of evaluation. And also, it's really important to understand that whenever the couple feels nervous or uneasy, I've had patients tell me that they've been tortured watching the clock for that 12-month time frame to go off so they could make an appointment. I always tell patients, you don't have to wait 12 months. You don't have to wait 6 months. You know your body better than anybody else. And if you think there's something wrong and you have a gut feeling that something's not right and you want to get evaluated, there's absolutely no harm in doing so at any point. So that's really important. And then the final thing is we, of course, want to see patients in certain situations that require some form of fertility preservation. So in patients that are diagnosed with cancer, that have upcoming chemotherapy or radiation, in patients that are going to have pelvic surgery and their ovaries are going to be removed for some reason, and also specifically patients that have genetic disorders that know that they have certain diseases in their family that they carry and maybe are impacted with as well, it's really best to talk to a geneticist and a reproductive endocrinologist because we actually help patients with pre-implantation genetics, meaning that we test embryos for those genetic disorders, and we can actually select genetically normal embryos to be transferred back to the uterus for that particular disease, so that this woman does not have to go through early pregnancy testing and then the horrific process of medical termination if it's a very serious disease that the parents do not want to transmit to their child. So we see patients in several scenarios, but in the fertility context, it is 6 months or 12 months or whenever you feel like something is wrong and whenever you get uneasy.
So when a couple goes to see a fertility specialist, what should they expect during their appointment?
I think mostly when a couple comes into us, education and counseling is one of the first things that we do, much like what we're doing today, in just making people understand, like, what are the essential ingredients to make a baby? And how do we test them? And what is normal and what is abnormal? And to just give a basic understanding of, well, if sperm is abnormal, we can do this or that. If eggs are abnormal, we can do this or that. Just basically doing counseling. You know, we rarely have to even do like physical exams and things like that, because a lot of what our counseling is dependent on is looking at hormone levels and looking at imaging. And then accordingly, based on individual patients' histories and case-by-case scenarios, we may or may not need to do an exam. This is why, ironically, about 32% of our fertility practice is completely virtual, because we actually don't even need to examine patients, to the point where we are actually even thinking of some innovative ventures of taking fertility practice to the home, as fertility is a very private thing that patients may not want to deal with in big hospitals and may want to deal with in the comfort of their own homes. And so more to come on that, but we're really in that sort of flex field of trying to adapt to what technology has to offer and see how, if we can even change healthcare delivery in our field.
For the two-thirds that you're still examining, though, what are you looking for?
Mostly what we're examining for is, and I'm not sure if we're really examining two-thirds, so we're actually probably examining even less than two-thirds of patients. But mostly for the men, of course, it's physical examination, looking at testes volume, and making sure that, you know, there's adequate testicular volume that the urologist does. But the female counterpart is where we come in as OBGYNs. And that's primarily to see if we find anything on imaging on the uterus and we're planning surgery, to do a pelvic exam to determine the uterine size, to get an idea of what route of surgery we would do, whether it would be an open surgery, a laparoscopic surgery. If women have sexual dysfunction and pain with intercourse, we want to check their pelvic floor and make sure that there isn't a musculoskeletal pelvic floor dysfunction issue or any signs of endometriosis in the pelvis, ovarian masses, and so on and so forth. But to think that every female needs an exam when they come to a gynecologist's office is also very archaic, and it's deeply, deeply based on the gender biases that we've had that continue to exist in medicine. We don't torture men every time they go to the urologist. Why should we torture women every time they come to the OBGYN's office?
And then how does the diagnosis process actually work?
So the diagnosis process works in a few folds. If we are talking specifically for the female, it is a combination of blood work, imaging, and a physical test. So the blood work would include hormone levels that are related to the number of eggs that are present in an ovary. Remember, we talked about the number of eggs that the ovary recruits every month. Mm-hmm. Those eggs produce a hormone called AMH, or anti-Müllerian hormone. So when we check that hormone level, the higher it is, the better it is, because it tells us more eggs are being recruited. And that hormone goes down with age. So it gives us a good idea of where women lie on the spectrum as far as egg numbers are concerned. Still doesn't determine egg quality, but egg numbers.
What about the fallopian tubes? What kind of diagnostic process is there?
For the tubes, we have to do a physical test, almost like an X-ray. And while the X-ray is being done, we put a very thin catheter in the cervix. It's almost like a pap smear, a speculum exam, and a very thin catheter that goes into the uterus. And while the X-ray is going live, we push some dye in the uterus and watch that dye come out of the fallopian tubes on an X-ray. So that's actually a physical exam and a test. And the last thing that we look at is an ultrasound, because in the ultrasound, we can look at the structure of the uterus, see any abnormalities in the fallopian tubes, the structure of the ovaries, and physically count the number of eggs the ovary has recruited. So that, remember, going back to that cohort or the crop of eggs that the ovary recruits every month, we can actually count that number with an ultrasound.
And how long does all this testing and diagnosis take?
So the testing, you know, blood work is just giving a blood sample. Testing the fallopian tubes is a 5-minute test, and the ultrasound is probably 20 minutes. It's not how long the test takes. It's when can we do the test, because we can't do the test at any given day. It's menstrual cycle dependent. Mm. So day one of the menstrual cycle is the first day of bleeding. Okay, day one. But if we see women on day 5, they just finished their period, they were just coming into the office, we still can't do any testing. We have to wait till the next month, because all blood work is done on day 3. Ultrasounds and the tube test is done between day 3 and day 12.
And what about the gents? How long does it take to diagnose them?
The gents, on the other hand, can go right from my clinic to the semen analysis room and give us a sample to analyze. But we do require 2 to 7 days of abstinence. So if somebody's had an ejaculate yesterday, today is not a good day to collect, but tomorrow will be a fine day to collect.
Now, can you tell us whether there are simple things patients can do to improve their chances of getting pregnant if they would like to? Are there exercises or dietary suggestions, vitamins?
Absolutely. I'm really glad you're asking this, because we're just wrapping up a whole textbook, Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility, where it talks about what can you do for yourself even before you go through medical interventions or to the doctor. But it's common sense things. It's basically things that keep us healthy. Both the men and women can start a daily multivitamin. Women mostly prenatal vitamins, but men also multivitamins, because both have been shown to improve fecundicity, which is that probability or ability to get pregnant, and also improvements in sperm numbers and egg quality. If you're smoking, quitting smoking and vaping is really ideal. For the gents specifically, marijuana use can really, really lower the motility or movement in sperm. So I think that's really important. And also one of the big, more common things is the obesity epidemic. We know that obesity impacts not only male, but also female factor fertility. So if women and men are obese, meaning if they're overweight, BMI above 25, BMI meaning body mass index, but more so obese, BMI above 30, losing by 10% of body weight really does tend to improve that communication between the brain and the ovary and the brain and the testes to make better gametes, more robust gametes, and better quality gametes.
And we should just add that gametes are reproductive cells, like the eggs and sperm. So in addition to vitamins, quitting smoking, paying attention to our weight, what about things that are actually happening in the bedroom? Are there certain techniques or products we can use?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, because even when you look at literature that's not medical, but like fictional literature and other old textbooks of fertility enhancing sort of sexual health and things like that, they talk about some really interesting things. The most common ones I'll tell you is like putting a pillow under the hip and raising the pelvic girdle for 20 minutes after intercourse so that the ejaculate can all stay in. Trying certain positions during intercourse, or waiting a certain number of days before having sex, or having sex more than once a day, or, you know, you name it. But truly, medically speaking, none of that should be essential or required. There are also conversations around lubricant use. And yes, if you do look at most lubricants, they do contain some chemicals that can be toxic to sperm. But again, these are more correlations, meaning the studies have related them to each other, but nothing that has shown causation. There are several companies that now make lubricants specifically for couples that are dealing with fertility issues. And those are conversations that we have with our patients that are actually having infertility. So for the general public, I still don't really recommend that they go buy sort of what we call the designer expensive lubricant just so that they don't have infertility. But I just want to make sure that we are aware that conversations around this and writings around this do exist on the internet and in the literature and the medical literature as well.
Dr. Khan, this has been such a great conversation. You've made a topic which can sometimes feel overwhelming, incredibly digestible and easy to understand. And we're lucky that we'll have you back for our next episode to delve even deeper into fertility care. We'll be talking about available treatment options. Thank you so much, Dr. Khan.
Thank you for your time.
If If you're wondering when to consult a fertility specialist about your pregnancy concerns, the general recommendation if you're a 35-year-old woman or older is to wait 6 months, or if you're younger than 35, to wait 1 year. But the most important thing to know is that these are guidelines and not the rule. If you're feeling very anxious, and especially if you have prior medical issues that may be related, if you've had ovarian surgery, for example, or a history of smoking, you don't have to wait. Go ahead and consult your doctor sooner. Your consultation might lead to a physical exam to check the testes or the pelvic floor. Some women might not need a physical exam at all. Women may have blood work, imaging, or a physical test to check the number of eggs or whether the tubes are open. An ultrasound can look at the structure of the uterus to see if everything's okay. And of course, there are always things you can do on your own in order to improve your chances of getting pregnant. These can be as simple as taking a daily multivitamin, and this applies to both men and women. Changing our habits, quitting smoking, vaping, and particularly marijuana can help too. Obesity can also affect your chances of getting pregnant, so both men and women who are obese may find that losing 10% of their body weight will improve the likelihood of a pregnancy. And of course, there's always techniques for the bedroom. Those you'll have to try out for yourself. Okay, that's all for this episode, but stay tuned for our next episode for part two, where we invite Dr. Khan back and dig deep into the available treatments for fertility care. And for more information on Dr. Khan's book, Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility and Conception, check out our show notes online. If you've got a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. For more Health Matters episodes and resources, head to mayoclinic.org/healthmatters. And if you found this show helpful, please subscribe and make sure to rate and review us in your podcast app. It really does help others find the show. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care and stay healthy. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.